I start talking now? I thought you were going to sing or something.
Is this girl you know it's Drew? I love Drew.
Yeah, that's good. We're not going to be singing Milli Vanilli right now, I don't think. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve.
Ezzy's actually lip syncing here, so you can't hear him.
Exactly. Actually, isn't Ezzy Milli?
Whatever happened to Milli Vanilli? That was like one of the best groups ever. Their hair and...
Except that they were completely frauds.
What?
They would lip sync the whole thing.
Next thing you're going to tell me, WWE is fake.
It's more real than Milli Vanilli. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We were talking about Brian Little before we went to break, and we'll continue on. Now, Richie, let's talk about sort of the how you went about your analysis. You know, what did you look at in terms of determining where Brian Little fits in amongst NHL centermen?
If we look at the points, Drew, what points? So I took the list of 20 players.
Right. We said there's about 20 comparable players who are, you know, who compare similarly to Brian Little.
I took the points that those players had last year, meaning 2011, 2012, and then the season prior, and looked at the averages, and then looked at their ice time. And so what I got was the averages from the players that we compared them to was about 38 points for those centers, those sex. So you kind of have a higher expectation, but really, as I say in the article, you know, the players don't really score 100 points anymore. So the second line center, maybe the fourth or fifth best player on the team, doesn't get that many points. So the average was 38. And Brian Little last year had 46. The year before, the average was about 32. It was lower. Now, I included players who were injured, and we're going to account for that later. I included some players who didn't play as many games. But I guess playing, and even if there's a replacement value, playing the games has a value in itself. So the year before, it was 32 points, and Little had 48. So in both of those years, he exceeded what I thought to be about that 20-player sample size. He had exceeded the averages in both departments. Now, that brings us to the ice time factor. And the thing was, is I put in their ice time for last season, being the 2011-2012 season. I put in the ice time, even strength, power play, and penalty kill. And to me, the most interesting point was that Brian Little actually had more even strength ice time than any other player that we compared him to last season. So that led to the fact that we need to take a little bit more of a proportionate look, meaning points per minute.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, it has to be mentioned, though, that the last 2 years, Little was the first line center, and it's a little bit. And again, you know,
and that's indicative of his ice time is because he was a first line center.
Exactly. And the thing that the problem with the Jets last year, there were many problems. Obviously, the record on the road and you know their inability to score goals at certain times and some of the deficiencies. But you know, Brian Little was getting second line center minutes, a little bit above average, like you said, as a first line center. Mm-hmm. So really, you have to really, you know, take that into consideration. And I know you did, Richie, that he got second line center minutes or just above those as a first line center and just really performed a little bit better than half of the second line centers.
And that brings us to the next point. You know, he had more points, but he played more minutes. So how did he perform, you know, on a ratio basis? Meaning, how did he perform per 60 minutes of ice time as compared to other players? Because they played a little bit less, but maybe they were more efficient in that time period. So we took an average and we looked at, you know, what was each player's points per 60 minutes of even strength ice time? And what were their points per 60 minutes of power play ice time? And we can do this because of our friend Gabe Desjardins has a website, behindthenet.ca, that provides these statistics. Little was actually below average when it came to even strength ice points per 60 minutes as compared to the other guys, because he was playing more minutes and he was getting a little bit more points, but he wasn't getting substantially more points, and he was in some cases getting substantially more minutes. On the power play, however, where I actually don't think Little's that great, he performed better than the average. So it's a little bit of both. I mean, you're going to play more of a game on even strength than you are power play.
And they'd throw him out there with Kane would go on there, and you'd get Antropov out there for power play. So he's playing with different line mates.
And then another thing you look at is, you know, how is he utilized? You look at who he played against, the quality of the competition he played against, and the quality of his teammates. And the competition he played against was actually quite good. And the reason why is when we get back to it, the fact that he played on the first line.
Right.
So when you play on the first line, generally speaking, the other team puts their best defenders against you, and that's who you have to play against. In terms of quality of teammates...
In that context, that's a positive. Yes. I mean, you know, he's putting up these numbers against the best in competition.
Yeah.
He's not putting up these numbers against fourth liners or third liners, which would certainly leave you with a great deal more of concern regarding his future performance if he ever got to be playing against first liners. He's currently played against the best that your opponent has to offer. In fact, if he moves down a line, his numbers could potentially move up as a result of playing against weaker competition.
That's exactly the it's a great point, Drew, and it's exactly the question. Does Brian Little's production go up based upon who he's playing against, taking into account the fact that he probably will be playing less? It's a great question. Which is obviously yet to be answered.
That's right, and it won't be answered until we, you know, get back onto the ice, of course. But let's talk about his teammates.
Okay.
You know, his line mates. You know, like we said, you know, Wheeler and Ladd last year.
You know, for the most part, I think it says here that he was a ninth in terms of quality of teammates he played with. I don't think it was actually that low. There are some points of the...
Now, when you say ninth, what do you mean by
on
ninth?
On the team. Ninth in terms of forwards. Other team players played...
So there were eight players on the team, eight forwards on the team that played with better players than he did?
Yeah, and that's, I think, is a little bit flawed. I don't think anybody would agree with that.
No, I don't... No. I mean, we saw the Jets team last year. I don't think that there's...
Right.
You know, I think he played... You know, granted, I think Kane is the best forward.
Right, but when we're comparing him to the other players, that the same flaws are inherent in the stats, so he's getting compared based on the same numbers,
right.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay, so... You know, overall, Drew, I think that he performed better than the average of these 20 players. But remember, we're really talking about the second third and last third of the second line centers in the National Hockey League. And I think he performed a little bit better than the middle, which would put him around, you know, the 48th to 52nd best center in the league kind of thing.
Right.
And that's... middle of the road, a little bit below average, second line center. And then I make a last point that there are guys like Sagan who are playing wing, who will play center. Horkoff, who's playing third line center, who could be in that conversation. Brandon
Little's
Sutter.
A pure center, though.
Right, exactly. So the point is that I think what you have here in Brian Little is you have below average, just below average, right around that area, about the 15 to 20 range, 15 to 22, 23 range of centers in the National Hockey League. So the problem, if you're a Winnipeg Jets fan, is then what do you have? And you probably have a below-average first-line center. I think there's no doubt about that.
Right.
And you probably have a below-average second-line center. And so the bigger issue, if you look backwards as to last season and you're expecting things from Brian Little, what you really had was a probably below-average second-line center playing a first-line center role against players like Malkin and Crosby. And to think about why the Jets identified that as an issue, I mean, it was blatant, and they rectified it by signing Jokinen.
Yep.
If not only because they knew that Brian Little was not able to handle that role, and maybe Ole Jokinen can't handle that role, but he can probably handle it better than Brian Little, plus he adds size and other factors that the team was certainly lacking in.
If this team ever, and you know, obviously they say they have a plan, and we believe that they have a plan, in their heart of hearts, they would probably say, for us to be Stanley Cup contenders, Brian Little is our third-line center.
Right, and the thing is, going forward...
I would agree with that, Drew, entirely, and I think the question then becomes, can he play the role of the third-line center, as the third-line center generally plays in the NHL, as the David Bolin, the Brandon
exactly.
Sutter, the Jordan Staal last year? Can he play that role?
And if he can't... A more shutdown role is what
exactly,
you're saying.
Exactly, and if he can't, then where does he fit in? Is he your classic tweener who you need to get rid of now?
Right.
In a sense, get a return for him, because if you don't, because down in the... down the line in the future, you see Mark Scheifele and somebody else being in the top two roles.
Right, and going forward, Brian Little, now, I mean, you know, we're getting into the line matching game here, and we've talked about it a little bit, but if you assume that Ladd is going to stay on the top line with Jokinen and Wheeler, the best thing to happen to Little is that he maybe plays with Kane, even though, as we said, Brian Little isn't... Almost to me, too, Richie, and I would agree with you that he's a second-line center, and he's probably an average second-line center. And that's just reality. I mean, we're a Winnipeg Jets-based website and show, but, you know, Brian Little, what he's shown to date, 24 years old, you know, in the prime of his career, he's been given an opportunity to play with Atlanta for many years. That's kind of where he's at. And, you know, for him to play with Evander Kane, and then maybe you have Kyle Wellwood on the right wing, or, I mean, last year, Bermie finished the season as a second-line center. There's a lot of question marks
there. I actually always liked Little and Kane, because I thought there was a speed element there that they could really pressure the opposing
right.
team.
That could be, better.
That would be probably his best attribute, his
speed.
Speed.
Yes, yep.
I mean, he's not big, and he's not a great passer, and, I mean, he's an average goal scorer. But, you know, he's got a speed element that you know, is probably, you know, where he ranks in the, you know, in the top of the team. If you had to pick one attribute, that's
right.
Where he ranks, is his speed. You look at him, and you look at Brian Little, just trying to think where I was going with the statement first. But, you know, you have to figure out how do you best deploy him. And there's no insult. It's not an insult to say that this is what your ceiling is. It's just a fact that not everybody is built equally. You can still have a very productive career saying your ceiling is really you know, a good third line center on a good team.
He's an extremely talented hockey player, and if you asked Andrew Ladd or Blake Wheeler, they'd tell you that they love playing with Little, and he's been part of the big part of the Atlanta organization. But when you're going forward, and you know he will eventually become an RFA, and you have to decide when you've got, you know, the core of your team right now. You've got Ladd under contract for 4 more years.
You know,
you've got Kane under contract for 6 more years. Then you've got Buff and Enstrom on the back end. You're going to have to sign Bogo. I mean, are you going to give Little anything more than a 2 or 3 year deal if he's going to eventually, you know, line up?
That is a great great lead in, Hezzy, because I think that's a great point. He's 5 seasons deep.
He's an RFA after this season.
He's got 1 more year left.
And he's going to be 25 in November.
Right.
So if you're looking at some of the facts, the numbers, a guy like Sam Gagne, who maybe hasn't reached the levels people wanted, but Sam Gagne signed for $3.2 million.
Yeah, and he's still an RFA, right?
Right, and he's going to be after this season. Yep. But when you look at it that way, I mean, is that what he commands at a minimum? Because he's a rat. Because, you know, they could compare them, right-handed shooting guys. Yep. I think Gagne is the better player of the two and the more talented of the two, but there are some places, you know, there are some points that you could compare the two. And while Gagne is two years younger, he's also played 5 NHL seasons, and their numbers are quite similar. So are you looking at paying him $3.2 million next year? And are you comfortable with paying him $3.2 million? Are you comfortable,
especially if he turns out to be your number 3 center?
Because you know, in a contract analysis, which we could do down the road, that's a great point, Drew, because will he be the number 3 center? And as a contract analysis, you have to think he'll get, especially with the way contracts are inflated as the months go by, at a minimum $3.2 million a year. And if that's the case, I don't know where the Jets stand on him. And you have to wonder if somebody like Brian Little is somebody who eventually, especially if they think Mark Scheifele can make the step to the second line center role in the next year or two, is on his way out.
If Little is $3.2 million as your third line center, putting on our forecasting glasses,
sure,
and Jim Slater is your fourth line center at $1.6 million, are you okay with that level of disparity between those two guys?
It could become an issue.
Fair question. Are you okay with, you know, $5 million being locked up in your bottom two centers too? I mean,
we don't know.
That becomes an issue. But it also is offset, of course, Drew, because Scheifele will be on an entry level. So there's many factors to take into account. And Jokinen, probably when Scheifele's developed, will be off the books, and they can give Scheifele money if he turns out to be the player they do. These are all the decisions that the general managers get paid the big bucks for. But looking at it right now, where Brian Little goes and what he becomes and how the team addresses it is going to be very interesting. And again, give us another sign as to how Kevin Sheveldayoff is going to run the show.
I get paid big bucks to say this, and I do think that Brian Little will play better and perform better with playing with Kane next year. I do think that. If he does.
We don't know that he's going to, but if he does. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, Richard Pollock, and our producer, Brian Remus.
Is that Michael?
It's Brian. We're calling you Brian from now on, Remus.
That's my middle name, Drew.
I know, and that's you're going to be known from now on as Brian. How's that sound to you?
What's your middle name, Drew?
My middle name is Malmid, which is my great-grandfather's last name.
All right, so I'll start calling you Malmid.
That's fine. Laura calls me that all the time. It might be a little bit odd for you to call me that, but that's a separate issue altogether. Anyways, welcome back to the program. The Edmonton Oilers have had a bit of an arena fiasco. I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not. Today, Daryl Cates, the current owner of the Edmonton Oilers and quite a wealthy individual, took out an ad in both the Edmonton Journal and the Edmonton Sun apologizing for his decision to meet with the officials of the new arena project that's taking place in Seattle.
This is when what you do is you go to Seattle and you posture and it's completely disingenuous. And he comes up and he apologizes.
Let's just sort of recap. For those who missed it, Edmonton, Daryl Cates is the Edmonton Oilers, and the city of Edmonton are involved in negotiations for a new downtown arena.
A new $450 million arena.
He wants essentially paid for entirely by the city and province.
Yes, he wants it to be very much so publicly funded. But he wants to own the arena. He wants them to build him an arena and hand him over the keys.
He wants to have his cake and he wants to eat it too.
Yes, certainly does want that. It seemed like the city and Cates had a deal done, more or less, a number of months ago. It was pretty close to being, you know, decided upon. And then Cates has gone back to city council and demanded changes to the agreement that was made, and city council pretty much said no, or, you know, prove it to us why it needs to be, why you need more money. Really, you know, as opposed to giving him a blank check, they asked for some sort of proof for why it's necessary. Cates got a little bit upset. He took his ball and went home with it and flew publicly, very publicly, to Seattle to have a public meeting with the group that's behind the new Seattle arena that's recently been approved and going to be built in Seattle.
When you say publicly, you said his own press, basically, department, his own marketing department, put it out.
Yes. In fact, the Oilers' Twitter feed made public mention of it. So it certainly was a thought of marketing strategy.
Well, I think a good word is what Richie said. It was posturing.
Today, what has happened is he's apologized for the public dalliance because he's been roasted,
yes,
both in the city of Edmonton and really publicly amongst
and that's just it, Drew. I mean, he's reacting to that. This is not a genuine apology as far as I'm concerned.
He's reacting to the fact that he got roasted.
That's right.
Here's his quote. Here's what appeared in both the Edmonton Journal and the Edmonton Sun. I owe you an explanation. I was upset when certain confidential information was leaked and by comments that I thought were unfair and called my integrity into question. I reacted by trying to send a message to city leaders that they should not take my support for a new arena for granted. In doing so, I took for granted your support and your love of the Oilers. That was wrong, and I apologize.
You can stuff your sorries in a sack, mister.
In hindsight, I have underestimated the degree to which it would be up to us to make the case for public funding. The simple fact is that the Oilers need Edmonton, and Edmonton needs the Oilers. Each is an integral part of the fabric and identity of the other. Does this apology do enough to undo the damage that Daryl Cates has done earlier this
week?
No,
it doesn't, Drew, because I think the first thing it does is cast blame on somebody else for putting it out in public, and whether or not that did happen. Who in their right mind thinks this team's even moving from Edmonton? So for him to threaten to move to Seattle was insulting to everyone.
I agree.
It was basically, I'm a baby, I didn't get what I wanted, I'm going to throw a fit about it. And hockey fans in Canada, specifically Winnipeg, specifically Edmonton, who've had the threat, you know, with Les Alexander.
Yeah.
Or
the Oilers were out the door and on their way to Houston if it wasn't for a last-second reprieve.
And that's the whole point. So they've their lovers have been hurt once, their heart's been broken, and they're very skeptical and worried. And I think he's played with it, tugged at their heartstrings, and I think I don't think it was in good faith. I think the fact of the matter is, never mind that the arrangement that he probably get in Seattle would be worse financially for him,
because he would
that
just
only
a,
underscores
he would the, just be a tenant in Seattle. He would not own any of the
that only brings to light, Drew, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that he was just trying to slap the city council in the face,
and
but
the
by
mayor
slapping
of Edmonton.
And I think this is a metaphor in some way, by slapping city council and the mayor in the face. Obviously, they represent the citizens, but even if he didn't intend to do so, he was slapping all the Edmonton Oilers hockey fans in the face. And now he's trying to backtrack. But what he has to realize is Edmonton, I mean, he obviously has the control somewhat with board approval that he can move the team. He's never going to move the team because A, it's too financially lucrative for him to move the team. B, his deal right now isn't as bad as he'd made out to be. And C, they're not paying for his problems.
Let's discuss his current deal. Right now, Cates pays $1 a year in rent to operate at the Rexall Center.
Before you say the next point, can we just point out the fact that he also has been paying himself in past years an annual salary of $250 million a year through Rexall?
He's been paying himself individually.
Yeah.
Rexall is his company, the pharmacy chain, and you're saying his yearly annual salary is $250 million?
Past years, yes.
Okay, it's his private company, so he can do what he wants. So he pays $1 a year in rent, and he also pays $1.2 million in operating costs.
Right.
In exchange, he gets all of the revenue from Oilers games, with the exception of parking, which is a 50-50 split. And he doesn't have to pay any of the arena costs, like any of the game-by-game arena costs.
Right.
Andrew Zimbalist is a college professor at Smith College in the United States, and he says the current lease agreement is a favorable one for Daryl Cates. Keep in mind,
right,
you know, when Barry Schenker owned the Jets before at Winnipeg Arena, he he didn't get any of the revenue from the arena whatsoever. That was one of the big factors in the Jets leaving in the first place.
Winnipeg Enterprises, what was it
that's
called?
That's right, Winnipeg Enterprises Corporation. Yeah. So Daryl Cates currently gets a great lease. It doesn't cost him anything to run his business, one of his businesses, through the arena, and he gets a share of the revenue. And so his public complaints about the current situation he has really do fall on deaf ears and have no basis in fact to say that he's crying poor throughout these negotiations.
What he wants to do is he wants to maximize his revenue, but he's being greedy. And the original agreement he had with the city, at least tentatively speaking, was certainly a beneficial agreement to him. But what he saw was he saw he could get more. And let's just hope this is not a sign for how the owners are going to react with the players, because if they get close to an agreement and see they can get more, they'll hold out for more. That would not serve the fans well. And in this case, I think this is a rich getting richer, and he had a deal that they negotiated, and if both sides are okay with the deal, as they seem to have been in the past, then that's fine. I have no issue with Daryl Cates negotiating that way. But when he tries all these antics on the side, it doesn't lend itself to a positive portrayal in the media, and I think the apology is as much to save face, clearly, but I think it's also to save his own personal reputation, which I don't know, which I think this tarnished, and I don't know if we'll ever recoup it.
And Richie, just for the people that aren't familiar with the intricacies of that, what you're talking about, the deal, it was that when he bought the team from that investors group, the Edmonton investors group, and when he bought the team, or around then, October 2011, sorry, not when he bought the team, he agreed to pay the mortgage payments, this is from the Edmonton Journal, for the new arena, $5.5 million a year for 35 years to cover that share of the arena's construction costs. And from what I understand from this article, now he wants that to be given to him through a subsidy by the city of Edmonton through various taxes.
It's like you said, he wants his new arena, but he doesn't want to have to pay for his new arena.
Right. And
we've talked about before, the fact he doesn't want a new arena. He doesn't want your regular new arena. He wants in this extravagant new arena, which will likely make the Oilers a top 10, as they read today, a top 10 revenue generator in the National Hockey League. But can you not do it with a little bit less? And remember, you have a bunch of money. You could pay for it yourself, and you probably would never even feel it. Well, making everybody else pay for it. And you're saying because it's going to revitalize downtown. And it may do so. Certainly the MTS Center has had that effect downtown in Winnipeg to an extent. But you're not asking for the MTS Center. You're asking for something that costs more than double what that costs.
You're asking for the Taj Mahal of MTS Centers. You look at Cates, and really all he's... I ought to ask about the Wayne Gretzky impact right before we go to break. Because Wayne Gretzky was with Daryl Cates in Seattle as an unwitting pawn, supposedly, to this entire charade.
Well, apparently because this
Kevin Lowe
was pre-arranged.
Daryl Cates and Wayne Gretzky were going to Seattle to see the Green Bay Packers Seattle Seahawks football game. Along the way there, well, let's stop in and make a public dalliance with the new arena and the people behind that in Seattle. Chris Hansen is the guy's name in Seattle. Let's go make a public spectacle of that, and let's drag Wayne Gretzky into it, where Wayne Gretzky really has no role whatsoever. Because I promise you, if Wayne Gretzky had any sniff ahead of time that he was going to be involved in a charade like this, anything that would harm his reputation in Edmonton, I promise you Wayne Gretzky would have said, Daryl, I'll meet you at the game. I'm going to take my own plane. You go have your photo op and leave me the hell out of it.
That's right.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. Producer Tim is back in the producer seat. We're going to be joined by Sean Gordon on the line coming up in mere moments. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and Richard's new analysis of Brian Little is available at www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's our good friend from Montreal and the Globe and Mail, Sean Gordon. Sean, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, just great. How you guys doing?
We're doing well. Thanks very much for joining us this afternoon. Sean, one of your most recent articles, I'm an old politics guy, so I really enjoyed this one, was about the different political ideologies of the NHL owners. Can you tell our listeners what overriding trends you discovered when compiling that article?
Yeah, most of the owners in the National Hockey League, particularly the American ones, obviously, are actually rather closely aligned with the Republican Party in terms of their political donations and in terms of their implication in various political campaigns and causes. And they're actually a group of NHL owners who are hew to an even harder right-wing line. And our Tea Party adherents, that includes Craig Leupold, who is the owner of the Minnesota Wild. And I should maybe qualify that a little bit. I shouldn't give him a Tea Party membership card. I don't know that he actually formally has one, but he certainly subscribes very strongly to the ideologies that underpin a lot of libertarian thought in the United States, and that's primarily the teachings of Ayn Rand, the novel.
Sean, are you still there?
A mix of characters, and I think that there's at least part of what's happening in the current CBA negotiations that you can chalk up to coming from very strong political leanings and a sentiment about a negative sentiment about unions in general.
That leads into my next question, Sean. You talk about the ideological bents, affecting these negotiations. Do you think it's simply... let me ask it this way. How big of a majority do you think of the NHL owners are very, not right-wing, but extremely right-wing?
Probably not a huge number. I think they're in a minority, but I think they're influential. When you're talking about Ed Snyder, who is the Philadelphia Flyers owner, who is a very influential and persuasive voice around the table and is known to be among the harder line guys, when you've got someone like Phil Anschutz, who is the wealthiest American owner in the National Hockey League and second only to David Thompson. These are people who carry a lot of heft, right? And Leupold's been involved in a lot of the negotiations. What's interesting is I think that there's a group of people who I think are broadly aligned with the hardline group, and I think that they're in the majority, certainly. And there's another group of people, many of them the Canadian owners, I would say, and several others, who are more interested in, yes, getting a deal that will sort of make the revenue sharing thing go away to the extent that that's possible, but fundamentally what they want is they want to get back to the business of hockey. And, it'll be interesting to see as the weeks grind on how that internal debate is resolved and who it is that succeeds in kind of not imposing their views and not even winning the argument, but who sort of, succeeds in shaping the approach that the league office is going to take.
Sean, based on your research and the conversations and interviews that you've conducted and had, do you think that the owners' political affiliations affect and are always in line with all of the matters as they relate to the CBA?
Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I mean, I think that there's always going to be fundamentally this isn't going to be about someone's politics. Fundamentally, I think it's going to be financial in nature, and I think that to the extent that we're still in kind of a fake war right now. It's funny because people tend to forget that, the season is not supposed to be started yet. We're supposed to be in, the end of the first week of camp here, right? It's not as if, the pressure points are anything close to as hot as they're going to be here within another 6 or 8 or 10 weeks. And I do think that How should I phrase this? I mean, you can be ideological until it doesn't make business sense for you to be ideological anymore, right? And I think that, above all else, the club of people who owns NHL teams, I think, are more interested in trying to carve out as big a financial benefit as they can from the CBA negotiation. And if it appears as if taking the hard line runs against the medium run interests, then I think they're going to just stop doing it.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Sean Gordon from the Globe and Mail. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Sean, one of the other recent articles you wrote about was the current ironclad solidarity, quote-unquote, that the NHLPA is currently experiencing. How has Donald Fehr managed to achieve this solidarity amongst players?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, there really is, you can sort of see the CBA fight as an ideological kind of tussle between, you know, the classic kind of big business, conservative, you know, Republican end of things versus the more lefty kind of big labor, you know, union movement of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and so forth. Solidarity is going to be, I think, a fundamental, you know, defining characteristic of whichever side manages to hold the day here. And I think that, you know, Donald Fehr understands that. And, you know, Donald Fehr learned at the knee of Marvin Miller, of course, who is, you know, before he became the baseball union head, I mean, he used to negotiate for steelworkers and auto workers and all that sort of stuff, right? And, you know, I think Fehr understands, and I mean, I sort of had an interview with him, and he said, look, he says, I understood intuitively that I had to do this, that in fact this was probably the most important job, was to make sure that I had a handle on the internal politics and then I could create, you know, a sense of unity. And I think that the way he's done that is through old-fashioned legwork. You know, I mean, he's a guy who has put up a lot of air miles, quite frankly. He's flown all over the place. He's visited all the teams. He's had private dinners with a bunch of people. I think, you know, it's probably not a stretch to say that he's had individual conversations with every single member of his union, from Sidney Crosby down to, you know, the eighth defenseman for the Montreal Canadiens, a guy like Yannick Weber, who has, I happen to know that he's met Don Fehr as well. And it's the sort of thing where, you know, he's essentially tried to create an atmosphere in which everybody has a sense that they have their say. And, you know, I think it's very interesting the way both sides have gone about this, because Gary Bettman is a pretty formidable fellow as well, and you know, in these kinds of negotiations. And he's done pretty well as well as far as keeping all the owners in the loop and the governors and making sure that they're all on the same page. And they've been preparing various segments of the strategy for the CBA for over a year. And so it's interesting. It's interesting to sort of see how this is all shaping up. And you know, the solidarity that the players appear to have now, I mean, they have, you know, in the memory of the people who work in the PA office now, which is, you know, not a lot of them are still around from the 94 lockout. There are a few. But from their memory, I mean, nobody recalls seeing 300 players at a union meeting as the players had the week before the lockout was declared, right? So it'd be interesting to see if you can hold it together and how long you can hold it together, because at some point, you know, it's no fun for guys, even if you're used to making millions of dollars a year. You know, if you make millions of dollars a year, then you live like someone who makes millions of dollars a year, and if you don't all of a sudden make that money, life probably isn't a lot of fun. So I'm guessing by the time that they've missed five or six paychecks, that some of these guys are going to want to be getting back to business as quickly as possible. So whether Don Fehr is able to breed the kind of patience that's going to be required for the players to get a decent deal out of this will be very interesting to see.
Sean, we've seen in past labor negotiations in hockey and different sports agents being fairly involved in the process. How involved are the NHL player agents in this process?
I get the sense that they're relatively kind of marginalized, actually. I mean, I know that the PA has been very careful about its relationship with the agents and making sure that, you know, they're kept up to date insofar as it's reasonable, because someone was saying to me from the PA side, you know, the minute you say something to an agent, it's public seconds later, right? And, you know, I think it can be a kind of a double-edged sword, if you'll forgive the cliche, because I think agents obviously are kind of, they're middlemen, right? And you know, a lot of them will have inroads with owners, and of course they represent the interests of the players. They want to see a deal whereby, you know, player salaries keep going up, and, you know, that means that their commissions keep going up too, right? So it's an interesting kind of a dynamic, because they're part of the discussion, but not really. And, you know, the PA is, as I say, sort of, I think, treading fairly carefully because they don't want anybody to have the sense that they're being cut out, but nor do they want, you know, everything that they say to immediately reach the ears of the owner. So it's kind of a bit of a weird balancing act here as far as the PA goes. And I think that from the standpoint of the owners, I think basically assume that the agents are hostile to their cause, right? So, you know, it's an interesting sort of, you know, we'll see how that goes, because that's also part of the thing that kind of happened in 2004 where you had some players and some agents kind of getting offside with the message, right? So it'll be interesting to see how this works going forward.
You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail.
Sean, aside from the fans, obviously, you could argue that the big losers when there's a lockout are the veteran guys that might only have one or two years left. And I believe your colleague Eric Duhatchik wrote a little bit about that in the Globe and Mail. A guy like Sean O'Donnell is an example of a guy who just got one more contract. He might be a guy that he doesn't play if there's a full year lockout. How does Donald Fear keep players like a Sean O'Donnell, players like that, in you know, on side during the negotiations?
I think that it's, you know what, I think that it's not that hard at this stage. I think that it gets harder as time goes on and people get more fearful about their futures. And I think that, you know, one of the virtues that Fear seems to have on the basis of what players tell me is that, you know, he's a very honest guy. So I'm going to suggest to you that in a case like Sean O'Donnell, he's probably going to tell him, look, I'm going to do everything I can. But I think you probably need to understand at some point, if they need to have a difficult discussion, to say, listen, this isn't about you, right? This is about, you know, the union as a whole and the membership as a whole. I think if Fear has to have those discussions, he will. And you know, certainly that's, you know, it's gonna get touchy, right? And in every labor dispute that the National Hockey League has had, and I think it's probably safe to say generalize about all sports, there are casualties. There are guys who don't come back. Sometimes they're younger, sometimes they're older, but you know, it's just kind of how it is. And yeah, it's going to be a real trick if this thing drags into February, March, April to keep people like that on side. It's going to be a real difficult job. But you know what? For the time being, I think Fear has consulted widely enough and has enough credibility and is straight enough a shooter. That he's going to probably have some political capital to you know, they're going to give him maybe a bit more of a benefit of a doubt and let him run with this thing a little further than they did say in 2004.
Sean Gordon from the Globe and Mail, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime, guys. Be well.
You too, Sean.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. You've been obsessed about this song all day so far today.
Well, this is exactly like Last Dance with Mary Jane.
Mary Jane's Last Dance, whatever the actual title is.
It's Last Dance with Mary Jane.
Tom Petty's, listen.
It's Mary Jane's Last Dance.
Yeah.
Is that not the exact same?
It sounds like
riff?
It's a very similar riff.
Yeah, and I got to find the rest. And it kind of just a whole Stairway to Heaven knockoff too, isn't it?
Starting
slowly going
spoken
fast.
Word. Can we play Tom Petty Last Dance with Mary Jane just to
and
hear?
And I like.
There we go. Here we go.
Sounds pretty similar.
Yeah, that's the exact same. Isn't
well,
it?
Well, they may be paying royalties.
Oh, they might be.
No,
I don't know.
No,
I
mean, they're not playing what? They're not playing royalties.
I would assume that they are if there's similarities. Otherwise, like
you never want to assume, Drew.
Check.
Although, when Danny California came out, there were some talks that is very similar to this, which I agree that it is.
Yeah, Danny California, it certainly got similarities.
Well, I took this class, and then actually our professor played the George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, and he was sued by, I forget who it was, for a song that was claimed to be similar, and he played both in class. Remus, check that, Google that. He played both in class, and I didn't even think they were that similar, and they got
John Fogerty got sued for plagiarizing himself.
Well, a lot of people thought that...
Did he?
Yeah.
A lot of people thought that American Woman by the Guess Who sounded a lot like American Woman by Lenny Kravitz. I don't know if that's ever been substantiated.
Thanks, Ezzy. I'll find the information on that lawsuit. But
it does sound very similar. I'm a huge Black Keys guy, by the way. But Richie pointed that out off air. And I mean,
just an observation. I actually like the Black Keys. Went to their show. It was a great show.
Proof's in the pudding.
I'm sure it's different, or I'm sure they have some kind of arrangement there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can certainly sample something if you're going to pay for it. That's all we're saying.
Sure, you always sample gelati at local places here, and you don't pay for it.
Well, that's what I do. You heard of bar hopping? I gelati hop. I just go from gelati location to gelati.
He's walking with like 10 mini spoons down Corden and hucking them on the street.
You're in the right neighborhood, Corden, Little Italy. It's the perfect neighborhood for gelati. I see you walking your dog.
I do know where gelati is available. You didn't need to...
Well, it's available other places, but I mean, if it's not Nucci's, I mean... Well, just like if it's not Saturday, it's not a legal curve. If it's not Nucci's, it's not gelati. That's my place.
You actually forget.
It's like when somebody goes on like Johnny Carson Carson back in the day and wanted free something forever.
Yeah.
The NHL and NHLPA have officially ended their meetings for the day. They went over hockey-related revenue today, so that is a good sign.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to take any silver lining, they had a good, you know, they had a frank, and I quote, this is from Steve Fear, so Donald Fear's brother. They had a, quote, frank exchange of views on language regarding the hockey-related revenue. They're going to meet again tomorrow. I'm not sure. They may go over hockey-related revenue again, but it sounds like more so it'll center on the legal issues, grievances, sort of, like we said, the secondary issues that they discussed on Friday, mm-hmm. and again, it looks like they're going to discuss on Sunday. So it looks like of the 3 days of meetings this week, only one of those 3 days will really be dedicated to the actual nuts and bolts arguments that really need to be resolved before we're anywhere closer to hockey returning.
And we'll really see what's going on here after Sunday. The new week starts. Are there more scheduled meetings, and how is this going to move forward? Another long
2 weeks
layover
off
here is not going to benefit anybody. And to me, absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, again, now every day goes by, and Sean said the season wouldn't have started yet. I think the season would have started around October 7th, 8th, or 9th.
I think the Jets' first game was scheduled for the October 11th.
Right, and I think they started a little bit later, but
yeah.
It was Carolina on Saturday.
On that Saturday afternoon.
Saturday afternoon. But I think the point is, Drew, now, like we're at today, September 29th, yeah. So we're 12 days away from when that would have been,
yeah.
And every day now you're losing games,
right?
So for you to stop for a 2 week period, you're essentially giving up, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 games a night time, you know, you're giving up 150 games, and it's just foolish.
And that's what we talked about at the beginning of the show. I mean, these next, let's call it 10 days to 14 days are crucial. Because you still have a chance, if you really, you know, hammered out a deal, let's say, you know, late next week, early the week after, you could probably still start the season in maybe end of October. But if you're not talking, you know, in mid to late October and you're deciding to take a month off, then you're looking at probably, and what everyone's saying is that, you know, everyone, it's funny, you know, in 2004, there was a lot more... There was a lot more fear that we could, you know, no pun intended, that we might lose a season. And this time around, it's kind of been like, okay, well...
It was sort of expected.
It was expected, but it was expected. Now it's half season this year. So everyone's been saying late November, early December, which really isn't really based on anything aside from the HBO series, maybe the fact that that's when you could maybe have a 50-game season. But really, that's what you're looking at. If you're going to take, you know, October off and part of November off, then that's what you're looking at. You're looking at hockey coming back in December.
In your opinions, how late can this go when they can still play a meaningful season?
Well, I mean, I guess NBA,
and
NBA
how many regular season games constitute?
I think the latest start date is when did? Well, if I recall correctly, I'm completely guessing here. If I recall correctly, I recall the lockout shortened 95 season starting like January 14th for the Jets.
It was January.
And I think they tied Calgary.
They did tie Calgary. It's 3-3. I distinctly remember that game.
Yeah. Saturday night, too. But, you know, Drew, I was
invited to a party after that. It was so rare for me in high school to be invited to a party that I distinctly remember the game.
That was your bar mitzvah year there. 95?
Yeah, it would have been.
Or was 94? 94. Okay, you're older than me.
Yeah.
94, Drew. I thought you were born in 64.
You just gave away Drew's age.
Damn!
That was actually my second bar mitzvah when you're 83.
Oh,
that's
do you have any party sandwiches left over from the bar mitzvah?
No. Those would be spoiled.
Drew, you mentioned that they tied, which I also recall. Did you wear a tie to that party?
Bow tie. Bow tie.
Drew rocks a nice bow tie.
When is the latest that they can go for?
Well, I think, Drew, literally, is what I just said. I think it's like that January. Remus, do you Google that, the January 14th? I think it was 14th.
It was January.
Like, it's mid. Yeah.
early to mid-January.
It's a 48-game season.
The lockout 95 ended in January 11th. So yeah. The first game has been a few days later. I'm working on it.
48-game season.
So there you
remember,
go. I mean,
remember what the scoring was. Jager Lindros tied. Yeah.
And then Zamnov.
That's right. And how many points did he have? I believe it was 62. And I think
70
Lindros,
was the winner, right?
Lindros and Jager had 70. That was a crazy year for Zamnov on the Jets.
It was a bad year for the Jets.
Well, I know, but individually, I think that was the year Alexei Zamnov had that 5 goals in L.A. when he did the one-handed goal. Anyways, yeah. We're digressing here, which we usually do here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. But... you know, I'd have to agree. I mean, you look at the 24/7 thing, and I do think that they are strongly, keeping that in mind. But, you know, I have to admit, over the last month, I've kind of changed my tune a little bit as far as, you know, when I think this lockout's going to end. I still think we're going to get half of a season. But I probably would have said 4 weeks ago that I was a little bit more confident that we would have either a full season or a 70-game season. But if if you're not playing in early January, Drew, then... That's not good.
Remo?
The first Jets game in 1985 was played January 20th, so a bit later. It was 3-3 Calgary Jets tie. Let me look at the top point getters. Phil Housley had 3 points for the Jets. That's Calgary, sorry. 3 points for Calgary, Fleury had two, but for the Jets side, we got Dallas Drake had 2 points. Zamnov, I don't know.
That's great. That's hey, pretty good.
You know what that was? That was a Jets redux.
I think we should just, like, go retroactively pick a Jets season, just recap all the games if there's not going to be hockey.
We should. I'm down with that. You know, I'm down with that.
Go game by game, remembering one random Jets season from the 90s.
Like when they got killed after that Turcotte trade in 96 and San Jose was in town. Oh.
San Jose used to beat the Jets every single
game. 7-1.
And that's when San Jose was
Craig
just
Gianni's first game.
Yeah,
I'll talk to my good friend Constantine, big fan of the show. Shout out to Constantine. I bet he'd be in for creating that Twitter.
Right, Craig Gianni, boy, he would never go into the corner.
Craig Gianni was our big acquisition
for
our
Darren
final
Turcotte.
Year.
Darren Turcotte,
yeah, because he played well with he played well with Tkachuk.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I believe it was Craig Gianni in the game 3 against Detroit that scored the opening goal for the Jets in that game.
No, he didn't. In that game, it was the goals were Tkachuk scored the first one, and then it was Dave Manson, Chad Kilger. And Olchek.
Drew, you've met your match here with Richie.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Savant Show on TSN 1290. Unfortunately, now Ezzy's dancing in the studio. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment of the program is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. For a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com or give them a call at 204-488-4520. Coming up at Rumors tonight, let me just go to that site real quickly.
CNC Music Factory.
Yeah, Dan Cummins is at Rumors tonight. Apparently the 7:45 show is sold out, but there are tickets available for the 10:30 p.m. show. So 488-4520, give Rumors a call. Have a great night out. Everybody enjoys a laughter every now and then. We enjoy our laughs on this show. So go to Rumors and you can enjoy some laughs there as well.
Does Rumors ever have ventriloquists?
No.
Never.
Well, ventriloquists and stand-up comedy aren't the same thing.
No, I know, but... I mean, it's a form of comedy.
But what kind of question is that?
It's, in fact, you could call it sit-down comedy.
That's Torts?
Can you play that one more time?
But what kind of question is that?
That was Torts actually asking that to you.
To you. Like, that's not a clip from some other thing. No, that was Torts to you.
Yeah.
Play it again, Rim?
Yeah. Me and Torts, we have a history.
But what kind of question is that?
Yeah. So you're actually hoping the lockout goes really long so you don't have to experience Torts again this year.
You know what?
Torts being John Tortorella, head coach of the Rangers.
You know,
Drew, you talked about banana torts and different kind of torts.
Yeah, schmoo torts.
That's
and
fine.
All that
you
sort
know,
of thing.
I'm a professional. I ask the hard questions. You know, sometimes the coaches don't like them.
Sometimes you get the hard answers.
When Rick Ralph needs his post-game audio, I get Rick Ralph that post-game audio. You know, someone has to go
even
in there.
Even if it's not the least bit usable, you get it for him.
When Rick that's Ralph jumps, as he says, how high?
Yeah. And usually, it's not very high.
It says jump.
Yeah, says.
Because Rick Ralph jumps, it'd be pretty high because he's tall.
Yeah, and I can't jump. Yeah. I'm about as flexible as this table here, so.
I don't even know what that means.
Not flexible.
A recap, we mentioned the game 3, the goals for the Jets. I don't have the order. We're scored officially by Chad Kilger, Dave Manson, Ed Olczyk and Keith Tkachuk. In my defense, Craig Janne did have two assists in that game.
Yeah. Larionov scored for the Wings.
Do you know who assisted the goals for Larionov?
I don't. I know it was Five-Hole, and I don't know who assisted.
Which one of those guys has been on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show?
He would have played,
Dave Manson.
He would have played with Slava Kozlov at that point.
Yeah. And, he had one of the assists. And if you get the next guy, because I've never heard of the next guy.
On who? The Detroit?
On the Detroit. If you get the second assist on that goal.
Is it a, hey, give me a little Bob Rouse?
Nope. It's a defenseman.
James, what was it?
Jamie Pusher?
Jamie Pusher.
No.
Hold on. It's another defender.
You got to give us a hint because obviously we're drawing blanks here.
It's a defenseman.
Well,
he was a former first round pick of the Buffalo Sabres in 1979.
Wow.
1979.
Only Drew was alive then, so.
You know, we should take a. I wish people didn't have Google.
What's his first name?
Find that out and then they would.
What's his first name?
His first name is Mike.
I still don't know. Mike Ramsey?
Yes.
Really?
Nice work. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Wow, I got it.
Assistant coach in Buffalo.
Well, hold on. Mike Ramsey was on the Detroit Red Wings in 96? That must have been his last year. Wow. What do I win, though I'm on the show?
He played one more. He played two more games in 96-97.
Oh.
Interesting.
Wow. Yeah. So, well done, boys. Now, for the next time, we're going to see how does it feel to have your lives wasted so far?
Drew, don't worry. It can get way worse than that. So
that's the problem. Like, you can do this all. Like, can you just pick out? I mean, that's a playoff game.
Okay.
Can you just pick out like relatively insignificant random games and do that?
Depends on how insignificant you deem them to be.
It's a little bit different though, because you're talking about Winnipeg Jets and people who are, you know, our age or around our age or even not our age that just remember Jets games. They were completely different. You remembered everything that happened. Everybody remembers that Nelson Emerson goal in overtime against the Chicago Blackhawks. And probably to Leafs fans, they're all insignificant. But
sorry. By the way, I just got to, you mentioned Nelson Emerson. So we were watching, of course, the Green Bay Seattle debacle this week on Monday Night Football.
It wasn't pass interference.
No, of course not. It wasn't pass interference, and he definitely came down with the ball.
Yeah, okay, of course,
let's pretend.
Golden tape.
Am I the only one who that came to mind Nelson Emerson throwing the puck in the net in overtime and them reviewing it and them still calling it a goal?
Yeah, like the video replay was not as extensive as it is now, so I think it's a little bit of a discrepancy there. But like, I understand your point. But I mean, that wasn't a throw. He didn't throw in the goal against Belfour.
Yeah, he did.
You know what? The best thing to come out of that thing, the Golden Tate, was that Ed Tate now called himself Ed Golden Tate.
Well, that's only because you called yourself. What did you call yourself?
Called myself Golden Ginsburg, and then Ed Tate responded to my tweet. I'm going to start calling myself Golden Tate, T-A-I-T.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So pretty much what you're saying is you've been upstaged by Ed Tate.
Oh, right. And I'm honored because he's a Hall of Fame sports writer.
That's right. And you're just, you know, you've been to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't.
You've never been to the Hockey Hall of Fame?
Never. I've never been outside of Winnipeg. I thought about going to Portage La Prairie once, but
you tripped out and turned back.
Yeah.
You've never been to the... I'm shocked to hear that.
Yeah, really? That's surprising.
It is a little bit shocking. I've been to the country music. No, I'm just kidding. But no, I've never been to the Hockey Hall of Fame. The HHOF, as they call it.
That's the Hall of Fame. Yeah, I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah, you should definitely make a trip out there. It's well worth it. Even if you've been there multiple... I mean...
I've been there three times.
I've been there twice.
And I've gone on a wine tour near Hamilton, but...
But you haven't left Winnipeg, I thought.
This story, the puzzle pieces don't really fit right now.
Serenity now!
There's some holes in your action.
Yeah.
So there's a couple Jets that are playing overseas in the KHL.
Yep. Kane.
Evander Kane obviously hasn't started yet. You know, Antropov is over there, and Ponikarovsky and Pavlik is over there. Mm-hmm. You know, Pavlik's been off to a bit of a slow start playing for his team in the KHL. Anything to be concerned about or just,
no.
You know,
I would take nothing. Any of the stats put up there, whether good or bad, really don't have much bearing on, I think, how they'll perform. Remember, these guys aren't... You're not dealing with guys who haven't really played, like a Yakupov. Seeing how Yakupov performs in that league is more interesting to me. A guy like Ponikarovsky, Antropov, you know what you got. You've had many years of seeing them against top competition and struggling against top competition, frankly, and maybe finding their roles in the second, third line guys, and that's what they're going to be. A guy like Pavlik, you know, it's very much to me like spring training. You want to work hard, obviously, but Pavlik's probably trying a few new things, and that's fine. I mean, he doesn't have the expectations of the contract there, so there's so many other factors that play in when he plays here. I don't really give it any value at all.
I'm not sure if anybody in this room saw, you know, Nikolai Zhirdev's goal in the KHL.
Yeah,
they were playing it on TSN, but when you look at a guy like Evander Kane, I'm sure, you know, having that extra ice for him. He's I wouldn't be surprised if he gets some highlight goals.
Yeah, that's a good point, Izzy. I mean, and that, well, you know, maybe on a negative side, somewhat. He played great in the World Championships, but in the negative side, meaning like Kane wants to be able to work on different things, and going wide on the board side on the left wing at the blue line was his calling card last year, and teams were cheating on him.
Yep.
Cheating on him, meaning they were pinching that boards and making him cut up the middle with some defensive support, meaning there's nowhere to go. In the KHL, he'll be able to go wide without really much issues. So you wonder if he'll fall back into that trend
if
again.
If he might rely on it too much, so thinking it works. You know,
but again, I think we're probably overanalyzing it. But I thought it was interesting. I'm not sure people saw the article today. And Remus, you can tweet it out. Eric DeHatrick article. And he's speaking to Paul Maurice. Of course, Eric DeHatrick wrote the article. Wrote the book, King of Russia, which Remus borrowed from me and still hasn't finished. and it's about Dave King's time right before it became the KHL, but coaching in Russia. And so he writes a three-page article, at least three pages online, about Paul Maurice's experience in the KHL, and how I thought the most interesting comment in the article was Paul Maurice saying, you know, I coach over here, you know, they, you know, one nice pass will override, you know, 12 poor passes, and they don't understand dumping it in. They don't understand, you know, not making the cross-ice pass. And he said...
Which, sorry for interrupting. I mean, we had Ed Willis on a couple weeks ago. You missed that. You were in Chicago for that one. But he said that was the big difference, you know, when the Russians first came over. Yeah. It was unheard of by Russian players to take the puck off of their stick, to just dump it in the corner. That was an unheard of...
And I think there is, Drew, still some merit to that. I do think there's some merit to that. But and Detroit still plays very much that way. So I think that still is ingrained in many organizations, particular ones, but I think Detroit in particular. But the point was, he said, you know, I've really learned a lot because these guys come over here having played this way their entire lives, and I yell at them, and I tell them for a week, and I want them to suddenly change. And he's like... That's just not the way it is. That's not real life. And I needed to come here, essentially, is what he's saying. I need to come here and understand that. So I better understand the players I'm coaching when he, I assume, eventually returns to the NHL. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, Richie, remember when...
Paul Maurice is a good coach, I think.
You know how old he is?
I bet you he's way younger than I think he is.
45. He's been around forever.
When he came in with the Carolina Hurricanes, he was very young. But, you know...
Carolina. It seems like he's coached Carolina 30 times.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about, you know, international play and... You know, just listening to Richie talk about it, we've had Bobby Holík on twice, who's obviously born in the Czech Republic. He was saying that he thinks that the ice should be bigger in the NHL. And I actually tend to agree with him. It is, when you add, you know, those extra feet, it's significant. And when you watch the KHL, it's like international hockey, obviously. And, you know... When you consider the strategies, it's much different. Lower scoring, it's obviously not as physical. There's obviously not the fighting element that there is in North American hockey. But, you know, people should, if they have a chance to catch some of these games while they can. I don't know.
Well, let's discuss that. If the KHL or some of these European leagues, and let's say the KHL, because I think most people would agree it's the best of the European leagues.
It is, for sure.
Yeah.
Started broadcasting, you know, on Canadian television. Would you watch it?
I mean, I'm obviously one of the hardcore fans in here. Well, that depends. I mean,
assuming the broadcast quality is up to our standards.
I'm not even going there. I'm going, is there baseball playoffs? And I'm not watching NBA regular season over it, because I'd rather watch hockey than NBA regular season. I mean, that's unwatchable.
Well, because we know the NBA, we already know what the NBA finals are going to be.
I mean, wake me up when the Lakers play the Heat. But if
what
baseball
about
playoffs...
What the OKC Thunder?
If baseball playoffs or football's on, I'm not watching it. If those aren't on, then I'd watch.
Especially because, I mean, you know, it's funny. I don't remember which one of our guests mentioned it, but they mentioned that, you know, how, you know, Rogers and Bell are the new owners of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And Rogers and Bell bought the Leafs, I mean, or primarily the Leafs, largely because of the programming that it provides.
Oh, yeah.
Same with Ed Snyder and the Flyers, you know, and all these teams that have their own regional sports networks. They own the teams because it provides them programming for their networks.
The new age.
Those owners, you know, might sort of be the wild card in the CBA negotiations as they struggle to fill the programming slots on their stations.
Oh, for sure.
Because they don't have the hockey that they really relied on.
It goes back to earlier in the show, Drew. NBC Sports Network paid a bunch of money to basically have the Jets, NHL as their primary tenant on a night-to-night basis. Yeah. They got nothing now. And I don't want to watch bull riding anymore.
Because NBC Sports Network really has got hockey scheduled... Yeah. You know, 5 nights a week. We've spoken about it. We were down in the, you know, for my wedding in Kentucky during the playoffs, and I was surprisingly impressed with how much playoff hockey was available to me. you take that away from the NBC Sports Network, they don't really have any programming, especially in the winter.
Yeah,
there's no primetime programming.
Venus, you like bull riding?
I actually like, they're showing Lumberjack on TSN. I'm more into that.
It's interesting.
They showed Tin Cup the other night. I mean,
they're showing Bull Durham.
I think I tweeted that out, that when you're watching Tin Cup, instead of a Toronto Maple Leafs inter-squad game, you know, then you know the lockout's really happening. But no, I mean, there's a remember
void.
What happened? Remember what happened in 2004? What were the two things that people watched way more of?
Poker
and curling.
That's true.
My curling starts in a couple weeks.
What's the name again?
Win, lose, or drew.
Let's go to break.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Richie, your world tour of Bruce Springsteen concerts continues next month.
Yeah, I know, but you guys are coming, so I don't know if that's good or bad.
Well, we're not sure. We'll have to see how it plays out. We're hoping everything works out.
Do you ever dance in the dark?
I don't. Welcome back to the program.
Do you ever dance in the light?
You don't want to see me dance.
Yeah, if I saw you dance, I'd rather you dance in the dark.
Well, actually, I'll be at a wedding tonight. I might have to dance tonight. Get the dancing shoes on. You can follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire, one final segment for this Saturday afternoon. Former Leafs goaltender coach Francois Allaire came out firing this week, claiming the other Leafs assistant coaches...
Nice pun, Drew.
Pardon me?
Came out firing.
Yeah,
nice pun.
Thank you. Undermined him in his tutelage of the Leafs goalies last season. Regardless of who is in the right or in the wrong, by airing the dirty laundry in public, is Francois Allaire blackballing himself from a future goaltending coach job in the NHL?
You know, Brian Burke was pretty loyal to him along the way, and I know then they had the words both ways. He might have. I think, though, Drew, it's a results-based business. And if Rick St. Croix can get James Reimer playing at a level that's far exceeds what he did the past 2 years, then I think probably, because you put the lack of production along with that attitude. Although a lot, these guys all have friends in the business, so probably not. You probably will know somebody who will give him a gig. But if St. Croix can get Reimer to play a lot better, then people will say, hey, his system didn't work, and that was why Reimer wasn't playing bad. Now, if Reimer doesn't perform well, that probably won't look as bad for St. Croix as it will for Reimer, and maybe Allaire's reputation will then be elevated by the fact that he wasn't giving any talent in the first place.
I think what happened, you know, with, you know, Francois Allaire, you know, criticizing Brian Burke, and, you know, kind of, it left a bad taste in my mouth, and it really overshadows the fact that Rick St. Croix, who obviously has the connection with, you know, the Manitoba Moose in Winnipeg, you know, it's a good hire for him. You know, and that it's unfortunate. And, you know, Drew, maybe Francois Allaire, it's quite possible that, you know, he's making it more difficult for himself to get a job. But, you know, it's funny, when Ron Wilson was fired, that was right around when the goaltending started to get worse. And, you know, honestly, he didn't do a very good job with James Reimer and Ben Scrivens and Gustafson before that. So it's possible that he's blackballing himself, but he does still have a good reputation. But this was, it kind of reeked of sour grapes.
The United States Hockey League recently received praise from Brendan Shanahan for introducing a new 5-point plan designed to combat dumb and dangerous play. In praising the initiative, Shanahan said, and I quote, "Instilling the proper approach to the game at the junior level is critical both to improving player safety and developing players who will someday become effective NHL players," close quote. Do you think that instilling the quote-unquote proper approach in juniors will do anything to combat over-aggressiveness at the pro level? In short, is dumb and dangerous play learned behavior in junior or acquired behavior in the pros?
I think it's learned. I think you start off a lower level, younger level, and I think that's exactly what you do. I think it's hard to nip in the bud at the pro level. It's ingrained in these players. I'm not sure how much it'll work, but it doesn't hurt to try.
Everything trickles down, but the reality is the majority of those junior-age players don't ever go to the NHL or pro.
That's right.
It is going to make a significant impact. And you know, Illegal Curve's Kyle Kozier worked with the USHL, and he knows Skip Prince. And, you know, it's obviously a good... This is good, and the thing is, you know, the USHL has gotten better and better over the years, and it's fed into the NCAA, and actually guys are getting drafted right out of the USHL, so even though the USHL is a step below the NCAA and the CHL, you know, this is a big deal, and, you know, this is one of those, you know, stories that it's nice to hear this story's going on, and not just the lockout story and the other kind of unfortunate stories that are going on. But absolutely, I you know, not getting into a you know, the fighting debate, but really it's the hitting from behind and the stick work and all that that really needs to be addressed. And if they're going to take this 5-point plan and it's going to make changes that are beneficial for the other junior leagues in the NHL, then, you know, that's great.
The NHL has hired 3 new officials from the Western Hockey League. While not replacement officials in the NFL sense of the phrase, they replaced 2 officials who retired at the end of last season. With the topic of replacement officials so newsworthy this past week, if you were a scab ref working in the NHL during a hypothetical work stoppage involving the officials, how many games do you think you could work before the fans and media began calling for your head and the return of the quote-unquote real refs?
Man, I've never ref before, so I wouldn't know how to do that. You, Drew, on the other hand, are the referee amongst us. Please tell us how long you would last.
Probably maybe 1 game. I mean, it's not like I was any sort of accomplished referee or anything. I know the rules of hockey. I actually think I could last longer as an NFL ref than I do as a hockey ref.
You do know your football rules pretty well. I don't...
Hold in the backfield.
We saw what happened in the Green Bay-Seattle game. Everyone saw
encroachment.
And, you know, they lasted 3 weeks. I'm surprised they lasted 3 weeks.
Legal contact.
I reffed soccer. I never reffed hockey. I coached and played hockey.
Whoa. You reffed soccer?
Yeah, 15, for many years.
15-yard penalty.
Yeah, 5 or 6 years I reffed soccer when I was younger.
Really?
Like 11 to 16.
Remember that? Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah.
It was PlayStation soccer.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, it was FIFA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think I would last very long. You know what? Let's just hope that, you know, scab refs are never used in any of the pro leagues ever again.
I think that's a fair comment. There's some hockey, some exhibition hockey being played in Quebec, mm-hmm. where a team of barnstorming professionals, guys like Simone Gagné, Brian Gionta, Andre
Talbot.
Markov, Alex Burrows, mm-hmm. Corey Crawford, Max Talbot, Jason yep. Pominville, played in an exhibition Team Montreal against Team Quebec. Shouldn't more NHLers do these sort of barnstorming tours in order to gain positive feedback from the public?
Of course. Olli Jokinen and Jim Slater could do like River Heights versus Charleswood or something. No, I'm just kidding. But no, but I mean, it actually is good because these guys are the guys that are kind of those guys that aren't interested in going over to Europe, and they obviously want to play hockey, and they're going to raise some money for charity. So, yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see some guys in Ontario and across Canada do that. Why not? Even in the U.S. There's a lot of players from Minnesota, Michigan, and all those areas, so why not?
Richie?
They got to play.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, Drew, that in this situation, all you really need to do is make sure that the fans are on your side as much as you can. So I think that would go a long ways. I don't think they want to take upon themselves that responsibility, though, because it's not, you can't just put a game together and go play at the local arena. You have to do a lot more than that, and it takes a lot more time. And they're probably taking the time to spend with their families if they do have families.
TMZ, that bastion of news-gathering legitimacy, claims to have video of former Blackhawks defenseman Chris Chelios burning a Jay Cutler jersey. Jay Cutler is obviously the quarterback of the Chicago Bears. While you cannot see Chelios' face in the video, the crowd of fire-worshipping onlookers is chanting his name while they watch the Cutler jersey burn. If you were a petulant, mediocre quarterback in the NFL and had your jersey burnt by a former NHL defenseman, which defenseman would you choose to do the quote-unquote honors?
I want to say, first of all, before Richie gets in, I watched that video, and I don't think there's any way that that's Chris Chelios.
We don't know for sure if it's Chelios.
I don't think it is.
Not.
I don't think people... I think it's they made that anyways.
That's why when I said called TMZ the bastion of news-gathering legitimacy, I may have been tongue-in-cheek.
I'd love to see... First off, if I was a mediocre quarterback, maybe Jeff Garcia, and I'd like my jersey to maybe be burned by maybe Randy Ladouceur.
You want me to pick a quarterback?
How's that for an obscure defenseman?
I don't really need you to pick the quarterback. I'm saying you are the quarterback. He just chose to throw out a mediocre quarterback.
You want me to pick a defenseman who I'd have do that?
Yeah.
Ooh. From back in the day.
Well, take a mid-80s, you know, early
mid-80s.
90s.
Oh,
an Mike 80s, Ramsey. Early 90s.
Mike Ramsey.
Yeah.
Mike Ramsey.
I was going Norman Rushfort.
Like, you could do your... Oh, see, I don't want to necessarily tie it to the Jets. Random. I read this in the plan before. I know. This is interesting. I'm not sure who exactly I'd want to be. Like, you know,
Because Don Sweeney was kind of above average. He's playing there with Ray Bork for all those years.
You can choose Don Sweeney if you want.
I wanted to choose Don Sweeney. Okay, it's got to be a defenseman.
Choose quickly. We have to get the cheers and jeers.
Yeah. Give me a little more time on this one.
Okay, we'll come back to you in cheers
you,
and jeers.
You always drop the Don Sweeney.
I like the Don Sweeney?
You're a big Don Sweeney fan.
What about Bruce Driver?
Hey, he was a cup winner.
And then he bailed on the Devils for the Rangers.
Hold that thought.
Should have kept him.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy. And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
What about Mini Driver?
Not good.
If you don't have a cheer, Richard, you can make this your cheer.
Drew, I'm actually cheering the fact that we went back to 3 hours of hockey talk. I think we're taking it upon ourselves to try and talk hockey for 3 hours every week, even if there's no NHL season. And hopefully the people who listen enjoy it, as we're always appreciative of their time.
Are you choosing Bruce Driver, though?
Yeah, Bruce Driver, number 23.
Okay. Is he?
Yeah, I'm going to cheer. You know what? I'll just cheer hockey because I know it's frustrating. You know what? It's frustrating for
you've cheered
for
hockey more time. You know, I'm
Eddie, is it Brodeur or hockey you're going to cheer this time?
Yeah,
it's like, well, I'd always cheer Marty Brodeur. But. I'll cheer the fact that, you know what, if you're an NHL fan, a Jets fan, I feel your pain. But if you have a chance, go out there and watch the U of M Bisons or the MJHL or the MMJHL, or if you have a chance, WHL Brandon Wheat Kings, because you know what, there's still hockey out there.
And
in a time like this, you know, we're going to go down to Grand Forks and watch UND like
Drew,
we always do.
I'd offer you a spot in the car, but it's full.
Yeah, it's okay.
But you know what, there's still hockey out there, and let's just try to get through this, because hopefully
Rainbow,
it'll
you
be over.
Come?
Thinking about it. I got to check my schedule.
Okay. That's open.
Yeah, it's open. Let me tell you. I've seen that schedule. It's open.
A lot of white. I'm going to wrap up cheers and jeers. We mentioned him briefly when we were in rapid fire, but I'm going to cheer Rick St. Croix for being named the new goaltending coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Obviously, a name well-known to Winnipeg hockey fans.
Yep.
You know, he runs his goaltending academy and everything else, so now he's going to get a chance up on the big show. So congratulations to
he's
Rick
going
St.
on the big
Croix.
Show?
No, I meant...
Oh. In,
didn't
not
his
the big
son
show.
Sign the contract recently?
At the Rangers.
Yeah, with the Rangers. Michael St. Croix.
That's right.
Exactly. So good for Rick, good for Michael, good for the St. Croix family. We made it through another episode. Thanks very much for everyone for listening to today's Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our guest, Sean Fitzgerald of the National Post, Richard Sturzberg, the former head of CBC English Television, and Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com, where we have all your latest Winnipeg Jets news and that great analysis Richard did about Brian Little. In case you missed any of this, a big thank you to our sponsors, Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, David Carr of Monopoly Realty, and the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. For my colleagues, Ezra Ginsberg, Richard Pollock, producer Tim, and Brian Remus, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Thanks very much for joining us. And if it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Join us again for serious hockey talk, Saturdays from noon to 3. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, only on TSN 1290, your official home of the Winnipeg Jets.